believe in yourself, cause it starts with you, and then everyone else will believe you too. And if it looks like you're the only believer around, just keep on believing, don't put yourself down, just believe.
Our guest tonight earned a law degree from the University of Michigan in 1992, became a lawyer, and ultimately a judge. He was appointed to the Oakland County Circuit Court in 2002 and presides in that seat today. He's the author of America's Survival Guide, How to Stop America's Impending Suicide by Reclaiming Our First Principles. And he's known as the Bowtie Judge. His name? The Honorable Judge Michael Warren. And I'm Jack Rasul, and this is Anything Is Possible, presented by Trust in Us on News Talk 760 WJR.
Now back to Anything Is Possible with Jack Krasula on News Talk 760 WJR. Brought to you by Trust in Us, a world-class executive search firm. Now, here's Jack.
We're talking to the Oakland County Circuit Court Judge, the Honorable Michael Warren. Judge, welcome. It's an honor to have you.
It's my pleasure.
Can we start by talking about your childhood in Detroit and your mom and your dad?
Sure. I'm an East Sider. My mom and dad grew up on the East Side as well, met in high school, were high school sweethearts, got married at a very early age. And I was raised on the East Side of Detroit and eventually moved over to St. Clair Shores. Eventually went to high school at Lakeview High School in St. Clair Shores. For those people that don't know, there's three different high schools and districts in that little bitty community of St. Clair Shores. And I went to a school in the middle one, which is Lakeview High School. My mom really was someone that worked from, picked her up from her bootstraps. She educated herself while she after she had me, went to community college and became a nurse, received a nursing's degree, worked very, very hard to do that. As while she was raising me and really had the traditional marriage of doing all the housework and all that other stuff while also going to school. And I very much admire my mom for that. My father was raised in a two-room apartment with lots of relatives and again, really became the fulfillment of the American dream, worked his way through high school, and eventually got a job, several different jobs, and eventually landed with the state of Michigan and worked for their child support network for many years and eventually retired from the state of Michigan. My mother's generation on her side of the family was the first one to go to college. And they always, though, instilled in me that I would go to college. And so I went to Wayne State University, thankfully was a merit scholarship there. A scholar there received a full ride, praise God, and it's a great program. And then eventually went to the University of Michigan Law School and had a wonderful education at the law school. And then my first long-term job out of law school was with Dorothy Comstock Riley, the Justice of the Michigan Supreme Court. Worked there for 2 years. She was a wonderful mentor, a world-class lady, and world-class legal thinker. And had a wonderful exposure to the law there. And then from there, went to work for a law firm in Detroit, Honeyman Miller Schwartz & Cohn, which is a great law firm. I was there for a little bit, went to work for the State Board of Education, spent about 2 years there when there was a window of opportunity for significant change in the school structure. Governor Engler had called for the repeal of the school code, and Clark Durant and the state school board at that time was very reform-oriented and decided that they needed some help, in-house help, to help them address the governor's challenge to reforming the school system. And I got tapped to do that. I was there for about 2 years, and we made what I think to be some very strong reforms in schools. In the statewide educational system. I'm very proud of that, although we didn't get nearly as much as we asked for. We shot for the moon and maybe, you know, got around the world, but we didn't get quite to the moon. And after we, after the window of opportunity for school reform had changed and kind of closed, I went back to Honeyman Miller, and then ended up doing corporate mergers and securities work. I did that for a few years, and there was a vacancy on the State Board of Education. I was appointed by Governor Engler to fill the vacancy, so I served 3 years at the State Board of Education while also working at Honeyman. Then Clark came back to me, Clark Durant, and asked me to help him at Cornerstone Schools, which is a set of independent schools that are based in Detroit, Christ-centered schools that reach out to children that don't have other educational opportunities. Very rigorous academic curriculum, has a parental covenant, has a school year that lasts at least between, I think, 210 and 220 school days each year, which is significantly higher than the 180-day standard in local schools. And I did that for a couple of years, helping them doing strategic planning, looking at improving their curriculum, integrating technology into the school, and a variety of other special projects. Then I lost my race to be reappointed to the State Board of Education, and which was a great blessing in disguise. You never know what the Lord is going to hand to you, because a week or so after I lost that election, I was appointed to fill the vacancy on a vacancy from a retirement from Alice Gilbert on the Oakland County Circuit Court.
Lawyers, most of them make a lot of money, Judge. Unless you're a TV judge, you don't make much money as a judge. Why did you agree to become a judge?
Well, I guess I'm a little unusual. I'm not really motivated by money. I always thought I would go into public service. When I decided in undergraduate to become a lawyer, I decided that I really wanted to go into public service. I thought I'd either be a prosecutor or otherwise be in the political realm and public policy development. And that's really what motivated me to go to school and or into law school and into the law. And so it wasn't a difficult decision for me to take a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity that Governor Engler so privileged me with to go into the judgeship. You can have a tremendous positive effect on people's lives. You also have the ability to be challenged each and every day to assure justice is done in your courtroom, make sure the rules are applied fairly, and to make a tremendous impact and give back to the community. And so that was an easy decision for me.
We're talking to Judge Michael Warren. When we come back, we'll ask him, what's it like? What's a typical week like for a circuit court judge? And I'm Jack Crisula, and this is Anything Is Possible, presented by Trust in Us on News Talk 760 WJR.
You're listening to Anything Is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR. Brought to you by Trust in Us, a world-class executive search firm. Once again, here's your host, Jack Crisula.
Welcome back. We're with the Honorable Judge Michael Warren, affectionately known as the Bowtie Judge. And today he has a red, white, and blue bow tie. Very, very patriotic. Judge, a typical week as a circuit court judge.
Well, the definition of a typical week is really an oxymoron in a circuit court judge's life. What we have a calendar, and in any given calendar, there are two main dates, at least in my life, that drive part of the week. Wednesday morning, I usually have 20 to 40 cases set to come before me to argue miscellaneous motions. On Thursday afternoons, I typically have between 40 and 60 criminal cases that are before me for arraignment, pretrials, pleas, sentences, violation of probation hearings, and sentences. Those are extremely busy on Wednesday mornings and Thursday afternoons. Monday, Tuesdays, and Fridays, and Thursday mornings, I typically have set either trials or pretrials, often both. And if I'm in a jury trial, it can be as short as a one-day trial. It can be long as a one-month trial. So you can imagine that if I'm in trial 1 month, for example, with a homicide case, that consumes the month and other cases get backed up. On the other hand, in 1 month, I might try seven different cases that have juries. And there might be civil cases and criminal cases of all sorts and varieties. So you never really can tell what will happen with a week.
Judge Michael Warren, what percentage of cases are drug related, and should we legalize drugs?
in the my docket consists of both a felony criminal docket and a civil docket involving controversies involving $25,000 or more. So putting aside the civil cases, because most of those really don't have drug issues. On the criminal side, I would say that substance abuse is either directly the charged offense, for example, possession of marijuana or distribution of and delivery of certain controlled substances, or is the underlying motivation or factor in the case almost half the time. So it could be alcohol abuse, operating while intoxicated, third offense, have a lot of those cases. You could have the drug cases, as I mentioned, or you might have, for example, a larceny in a building where someone breaks in, they ransack a safe, steal some money, but they're doing it for their drug habit. And it is, I would say, you know, a good 50% of our cases at least are either the underlying causes, substance abuse, or the actual charges of substance abuse. Your second question is whether or not we should legalize drugs. That's a policy question that's beyond my scope. And and so it's really up to the legislature. I don't think that is something that has a lot of vibrancy today. It seems like it's a fait accompli that those drug laws are going to remain in effect. I think the more salient question is whether or not we are doing a good job with people that have substance abuse problems and addictions with addressing those challenges. In Oakland County Circuit Court, thankfully, we have something called the Adult Treatment Court, where folks that have addictions can be treated with intensive probation with the threat of jail or prison over their heads. But that's grant-funded, and the grant are very, very restrictive in who can apply for those and be put in the program. We have what's called a zero tolerance program where somebody goes and gets tested, and if they continue to test clean, they don't have to serve jail. If they test and it looked like they've abused substances, then they have to serve a jail sanction. We have a few other programs like that. We also have one where you can send someone in for residential treatment, drug treatment. And I think we need more of those and a more a wider array of options to deal with what some people might consider to be victimless crimes to address those issues.
Judge Michael Warren, you have a reputation of often having your defendants write essays. On what and why?
Well, I do have that reputation. Actually, I'm very proud of that reputation. What has happened is that many people come to court without reflecting upon their own actions or the consequences of their actions. So you might have an individual who has a consistent problem with violating the terms of probation, flagrantly disregarding the law and law enforcement, criminal procedures. And so I will order them often to write an essay regarding the importance of respecting the rule of law, which is a fundamental first principle, which is that the law will govern not your own personal desires, and that will govern both the government as well as individual behavior. Often, I receive a blank stare when I say that because they've never heard of the phrase, they've never really reflected on it. When I make them write the essay, usually it's 1,000 to 2,000 words. After they've written it, often they will write at the very beginning, "This is the first time I've ever had to think about this, about the importance of why we should respect the law." And often they will then go into an incredibly thorough and understanding reflection of the importance. So I think it does help reduce recidivism and help them understand why breaking the law is such a destructive behavior. Others, for example, might have substance abuse problems, and I'll make them write about, for example, the dangers of drunk driving on themselves and society. So, for example, you might have someone that's pulled over and they have a minor child in the car, and they have a very high blood alcohol level content. They endanger themselves, they endanger the child, they endanger the drivers on the road, who also might have children in their cars. So when I make them write those essays, again, they start to reflect about, and hopefully they're genuine in what they write. You know, they hadn't thought about this before, they understand that it's serious, that they need help. And often that can be a turning point in the lives of defendants when they have that ability to reflect. And nobody's asked them to do this before. They just kind of go through society. They you know, have, for whatever their background, their upbringing, they were never told to respect the law, never told not to abuse substances, etc. So this is the first time this has happened to them.
In the previous segment, you talked that you were a former member of the State Bar of Education. Can you talk to us about how the current educational model evolved?
Well, we have, the evolution's a very long history. But what has resulted in the evolution is what I consider to be a archaic system. We have a system which is in part based on feudalism. In other words, it is defined by the land. Historically, serfs were tied to the soil. Their power generated from the kind of the privileges granted to them by their barons and all that. And we have a system today that's defined by, for 95% of the children, geography. Where you live is your compelled school of attendance. There may be charter schools, but that's a small number, and that's a big break from the old paradigm. The schools are elected by the school boards are elected by land-based units. And also, we have an agricultural system of the calendar. They used to have the summer off so they could go off into the fields and help with the farms, and we've kept that going so that we have these big breaks in the middle of, in the spring and summer. And that's academically counterintuitive because kids lose a lot of what they've learned in the school year because of those breaks. We also have a system that is based on the industrial model. Detroit is the epitome of the factory town, where everybody went to work in a big building at the same time. They learned the same thing at the same pace and had routine production model of producing goods. And here in education, we kind of do the same thing. We bring everybody to this big building. They all go. They're classified by age, not by their talent or their needs. They're lined up in rows in front of blackboards, and they have somebody kind of just lecturing to them about what they should learn. They're all learning at the same pace, same time. It's a very archaic way of learning, and is something we really need to be challenged by.
We're talking to the Honorable Judge Michael Warren. When we come back, we'll ask him how he thinks the educational services should be going forward. And I'm Jack Rasul, and this is Anything Is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR.
Welcome back to Anything Is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR. Presented by Trust in Us, a world-class executive search firm. Now, here's your host, Jack Krasula.
We're with Oakland County's Circuit Court Judge, the Honorable Judge Michael Warren. Judge, how should we design educational services going forward?
It's a wonderful question. If you were to take the amount of money that we have today in public education, which is about $13 billion annually in Michigan, and start from scratch and say, we have this very large pot of money, $13 billion. We educate 1.7, 1.8 million kids a year. How would we design a system to do that? You probably would not end up with the system we have today. Well, and Michigan has been in the forefront of dealing with legacy costs. You look at what's happened with the Big Three and the utilities. You know, we are a state that was so far ahead of everyone else that now we have these legacy costs, and how to change the paradigm of organization and production is our fundamental challenge. And it's very similar for public education. We have, as we mentioned in the last segment, a system of education that's designed around land and designed around synchronization, centralization, uniformity, and having kids show up in big buildings lined up in front of teachers that lecture at a pace that may not be at for the kids' best education. So I think first you have to decide as a state that we have to move beyond the current system, that we should not educate in a way that's designed simply around geography, that we should break out of the feudal model that the kids are tied to the soil and allow the and instead educate children based around their needs and their aptitudes and the educational desires of their parents, as opposed to trying to maintain this current system. I think also that you need to break out of the idea of classes in grades that are based on age, and instead start designing an educational system and services around the students and their needs, which is a fundamentally new way of thinking about education. Because today, if you know you're born by such and such a date and such a year, you're going to be in a cohort with a bunch of other kids that same age. You're going to be in a classroom with a teacher, probably teaching all the kids at the same time, the same pace, the same subject. The kids that are struggling with that content fall behind. The kids that are more advanced get bored, and then the kids in the middle just kind of limp by. That's not to say that there aren't wonderful teachers out there that aren't working really hard, that there aren't aberrations to this or exceptions to this, but that's the general model. And we really need to start designing the system where we can differentiate curriculum, start customizing like we do in so many other areas of our lives to reach the needs of the students, as opposed to just perpetuating the status quo.
Judge Michael Warren, these are approximate numbers, as I understand. Michigan gives approximately $10,000 per student. We have 25 kids in a class. That's $250,000 each year per classroom. You have one teacher. Let's say the average teacher's compensation with benefits is around $75,000. That means each classroom has an extra $175,000 left. And we're all screaming, we need more money, we need more money. Judge Michael Warren, where does it go?
Well, if you were to look at the budget structure of current public schools, and I'm not going to quibble with the numbers. I don't know that the numbers are exactly right. There's a foundation grant that's more like $9,000 or $8,500, but there's bond money and there's other sources of revenue, grants, et cetera. Let's take your numbers for what they are. If you look at statewide studies, they show that the money that goes to administrators, that goes to buildings, that goes to transportation, that goes to lunch, that goes to physical education and sports, is a tremendous amount of the budget. And there, I think there is a fundamental question about whether or not we are directing our tax dollars in ways that are that is most efficient and effective. The budget, there was a study done which shows that in Michigan, unfortunately, the percentage of funds that goes towards administration, I think, is the third worst in the nation versus in the classroom. So that's something that should be looked at. You should also know that charter schools, for example, which just have the basic foundation grant, their numbers are significantly below the $10,000 threshold, and they don't have bonds and things like that mostly, and yet they're able to educate their students. So I don't believe that the challenge is the amount of money. I believe the challenge is what you do with the money.
Tenure. What should we do about tenure?
Well, I don't really have I'm a very opinionated guy, but I don't necessarily have an opinion about tenure or not. I do think that we have many excellent teachers that should be rewarded. We also have some folks that aren't up to snuff, and their performance needs to be challenged. And tenure, I think, over rewards people that are not up to snuff and need help, and under rewards those that are excelling because they're treated in the same level as others that just get into the tenure system.
Your recent book is entitled America's Survival Guide: How to Stop America's Impending Suicide by Reclaiming Our First Principles in History. What's the theme of the book?
We hold these truths to be self-evident: that all men and women are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain inalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, and that to secure these rights, governments are instituted among men and women. Those words from the Declaration of Independence were revolutionary in 1776, and they remain revolutionary today. Those founding first principles, the rule of law, equality, the social compact, unalienable rights, and limited government, are what bind this country together and make it the exceptional flame of the torch of liberty for millions, really billions of people across the world. Unfortunately, over the last couple of generations, we are forgetting what our founding principles are. We're also ignoring our founding history, for which those first principles then became embodied into the Constitution and to our governmental structure. And as a free republic, in other words, as a country in which we're dependent upon citizens to be engaged and to vote and participate, we're at grave risk as a survival as a free republic if our citizens are ignorant or hold in disdain, because there are some people out there that attack our founding first principles and denigrate our history. If we don't embrace those and reclaim those founding first principles in history, our survival as a free people is at grave risk. And I have a set of recommendations about what to do about the crisis, so it's not just all doom and gloom. It's also about how to attack the crisis.
What are those recommendations?
The last chapter of the book is dedicated to those. There's education reform, media reform, holiday reform, political reform, and some others. And we're doing one of them right now, media reform, which is that, you know, there's so much out there right now that media coverage, you know, we have the internet, we have cable, we have radio, we have DVDs, all this other stuff. But so little of our media coverage actually addresses our founding first principles and our history. So just reminding people that there are founding first principles, that the rule of law does matter, that people are created equal, that they're endowed with certain unalienable rights, that the government should be limited, that we're a social compact, that we believe the people are sovereign and have united in a certain way to protect our freedoms, and that there's a constitutional structure designed to protect that. Just reminding people of that is one of the things we need to do. So I want to thank you. Not only do you have a great show in the sense that you remind people that anything can happen and that there are great things that can happen if you put your mind to it, but also for spreading the word about this.
We're talking to the Honorable Judge Michael Warren, and I'm Jack Crisula, and this is Anything Is Possible, presented by Trust in Us on News Talk 760 WJR.
Trust in Us, a world-class executive search firm, presents Anything Is Possible with Jack Crisula on News Talk 760 WJR.
Welcome back. We're with the Honorable Judge Michael Warren. Judge, if you could get every listener tonight to do one thing, what would you have all of us do?
Well, other than buy my book, which is available at www.americassurvivalguide.com and amazon.com.
Just like Judge Judy, you know?
You gotta plug the book, americassurvivalguide.com. Putting that aside, what I think the key to reforming and saving the country is the adoption of what I call the American Freedom Curriculum. The American Freedom Curriculum is designed to ensure that when our students graduate, that they will have the intellectual firepower to participate in our republic in a meaningful way and to preserve our freedoms and their freedoms. And so what I would ask them to do is to lobby their local representatives to adopt the American Freedom Curriculum, because if we can do it, Michigan's also often been on the forefront of education reform. If we were to do that, I think it could be a national model and a spark of reform across the country. And just to give some background to that, it is illustrated in the book, but to give some background to that, we have a system which is, we have a lot of hardworking people, some just excellent teachers, working in a system that's designed to stop them from succeeding. We have a system that basically puts most of American history in fifth grade. Sprinkles a little bit of civics and history, but not U.S. history, in elementary school. So after fifth grade, it stops. Then it skips to junior high. Again, goes back to American history, does a little bit, then stops. Skips a few more grades, and then goes into high school, and for a little bit. And then there's also a civics component, one class in high school. You might say to yourself, "Well, that's a lot of time." Actually, if you think about it, with those big gaps, the kids aren't learning and retaining the information, because what happens is we teach it sequentially, in other words, in chronology. So in elementary school, they learn the colonial era, the American Revolution, and the Constitutional Convention. Then they stop. They skip a few grades. They come back in middle school. They pick up around the Constitutional Convention, maybe after that, and they go to the Civil War. Then they stop for a few years. They come back, and then they learn the Civil War to modern time, which means that the American Revolution, Thomas Jefferson, James Madison, George Washington, Thomas Paine, all the founders, the kids are supposed to remember all that from fifth grade at a fifth grade level of education. And then we come back and look at all the studies that are, and there are many studies, that show that our students don't understand American history and government, that they are not engaged in the political process, don't think they can make a difference. Well, if the last time they heard about the cause of the American Revolution, the Declaration of Independence, and the Constitutional Conventions in fifth grade, are we shocked that they don't remember that? Obviously not. So my suggestion is that every year, beginning in kindergarten, all the way through 12th grade, we teach American history and civics, that as the children learn about it, we circle back and go back to the founders and the revolution, the Constitutional Convention, and add detail, flesh it out, and add deeper concepts, so that by the time they graduate, it is instinctive that they know what's in the Declaration of Independence. They understand the constitutional structure and can protect their liberties and their unalienable rights. And that was, initially, when we created public schools, it was for two main purposes. One, to teach kids how to read the Bible so that they could be saved, to read scripture. And secondly, to understand American government so they could be active participants and informed and competent participants in our political process. And right now, we're not doing the job on the second part at all. Our students, just as a whole, again, there's lots of exceptions and there are many excellent students and teachers, but as a whole, our system is failing to educate our students in a way that they will become engaged and in a competent and a meaningful manner in a political system.
Judge Michael Warren, are you hopeful about America's future?
I am a pessimistic optimist. I think that, as you pointed out earlier, I think we're at a very important time in our nation's history where we can either re-embrace our founding first principles and reinvigorate the American dream and save our freedoms, or we can continue to go down the path that we're going, which will ensure the downfall of America either through an authoritarian government, through a totalitarian government, or socialist communist government. I can't tell you which form it will take. But what stops America from lurching into fascism or into communism or totalitarianism or authoritarianism is those founding first principles and our adherence to the rule of law, equality, etc. And once enough people don't care about that, don't understand it, and denigrate it, then it won't matter. The system will lurch and flip over, and we're getting close to that tipping point. We have a whole generation of kids that are now adults, that are out there voting or not voting, that are not informed. And in fact, in 1983, there was a report by the federal government called The Nation at Risk, and it was about the failure of our educational system to meet the needs of students. And it dealt with math and science and reading, but it certainly could apply to social studies. It's now 2008. So one generation of kids that went to school in 1983 in kindergarten have graduated and gone K through 12. And then there's another K through 12 generation. So we've got two sets of kids. And that crisis had existed well before the time of the report. And we're basically at the same point that we were back in 1983.
Judge, you're a man of faith.
Yes.
When you pray, what do you pray for?
I pray to be a better father, to be a better husband, to be a better judge, and to allow, I ask for God's blessing to help me use my talents to help others. And then, of course, I also pray for my family and my friends, and if someone's ill or has special needs, I always try my best to include them in the prayers.
One of the hardest things for so many of us is to surrender to God's will. How do you try to do that?
Well, I do think that prayer has a great deal with that. And you know, I try very, very hard to seek the Lord's guidance, and it is not an easy thing, I think, instinctually for anyone, as you just mentioned. But I pray, and I look at other people's examples. I look at other folks around the world and the sacrifices they've made for God, and try my best to keep that at heart. You know, we're, in one sense, very spoiled in America. We really have the blessings of liberty and freedom, and often I think we need to look outside of ourselves to see those blessings and how we can help better the world.
Last question. What advice would you give to our young listeners tonight, Judge Michael Warren?
I'd ask our young listeners to read the Declaration of Independence, to reflect on how the Declaration of Independence has formed us as a country, to reflect upon the great blessings of liberty that we've been given, and then to work hard and be disciplined in their studies, and to dedicate themselves to maintaining the wonderful freedoms and liberties that we have been given.
The Honorable Judge Michael Warren, I want to say thanks for what you've done for this area, for this state, and how you've done it with the principles that you live every day. Thanks for coming on.
Thank you very much.
Our guest next Sunday will be another lawyer. She's 28 years old. She got her law degree from Harvard, and in 2003, she was Miss America. Miss Erica Harold. So she's a much more beautiful, attractive lawyer than our guest this evening. So, and me as well. Until then, I'm Jack Rasula. Thanks for listening. And make it a great week, because with God, anything is possible.